Yeah, no, so after listening to talks yesterday, I have some serious plant envy, and I feel like I'm taking the wrong career turn.
Never too late.
Yeah, never too late. I'll come back to the plant in a bit. So, key difference from other animals we've seen so far is that mammals grow in the womb. Presumably, there is no constraint yet. There is no limitation in terms of nutrients. Things take a long time to develop. Anywhere between, I think it's a process to several months. And the most dramatic thing that you see about mammals is the variation in size. And as an open question, it's not understood how you get such dramatic size. So that's what we're doing here. Just like with the animal size, there are dramatic variations in organ size, something that we've been working on for the last 5 years, brain development. And in the case of the human cortex, again, it's expanded dramatically. One of the questions we're interested in is how does this expansion happen? What are the molecular reasons for such expansion? And I'll come back to that at the end of the talk. So the outline is as following. Boris told me I have to introduce mammalian development of stem cells, so I'll do that. And I'll do it through the context of gastrulation. And then I'll tell you some about signal response and signal sensing. Particularly context of mammalian development seen through our lens, so it's all biased by our work. I then want to tell you about challenges with computation. Given the amount of data that's being generated, one can answer open questions that you were saying, that have been asked for a long time now. And there are fundamental challenges in terms of data analysis, and there aren't very many physicists doing anything like this, and so I think there's lots of room here, and I'll hope to solve that. And then I'll finally come to brain development. So, human embryo, you start off with the cells, divide, you form this blastocyst. Inside the blastocyst, you have the inner cell mass. And then this goes on to become an embryo. Human embryo looks like this, according to my cartoon. It's roughly like this if you look at the images. The most important thing is the sheet of yellow cells. It's an epithelial monolayer of cells. Again, watertight, periton junctions, as you've heard of before. And this part is going to form you, basically. Okay. A single sheet of cells is how you start. If you take this inner cell mass and put it in a plate, you can maintain them. These are embryonic stem cells. And so we work with embryonic stem cells because human embryos are hard to get to. But I'll come to some data on human embryos towards the end. And this gives you a window into my obsessive personality. I saw stem cells and I thought, maybe I'm working on plants. And then I thought, okay, I should Google and see how stem cells started. And I thought, meristem stem cells. Turns out that the person who first named stem cells was this guy, Ernst Haeckel, whose name I had come across before for some other reason, and I'll give you a quiz. He was a proponent of Darwin's work. He established a library and a museum trying to propagate Darwin's work. He wrote an article on how it's important to teach evolution in schools, telling you how far back we've gone currently. And there's this beautiful paper on the history of why these are called stem cells. Turns out, this guy is famous for his proponent of recapitulation theory, which is that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And he went around collecting lots of animal morphology, classified them, tried to build an animal tree. And his deal was there must have been a single cell organism at the base of the tree, and that's the stem. So the tree is not the plant related to meristem, but the plant related to the tree of evolution. And because of this ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny business, he decided that that single cell that started must be the single cell. And so he called it a stem cell. Meristem apparently is derived from a Greek word, which is, yeah, separate. But I can quote you also the Wikipedia article from last night, but I'll stop. So you can take these cells, as I said, grow them in a dish, and they form an epithelial monolayer. Blue, if you can see it, are nuclei. Forget about the red. The white are tight junctions. So it's a stain that marks tight junctions. It forms a monolayer exactly like it does in an embryo. Different mammals have different geometries of these cells. This is a mouse embryo, same set of yellow cells, tight junctions, monolayer. Human, Pig is more similar to human. Rabbits are supposed to be similar to human. But the geometry changes rather dramatically from one animal to the other, even this early in development. Again, I've quoted textbook articles. There's enormous amounts of literature, which I can't possibly fit in here, but it's just 50 years of beautiful work.
What does E5.5 mean, short?
Good question. I'll define it now instead of later. Fertilization happens at E0. This is 5.5 days into embryonic development. And so you'll see these numbers. So the E5.5 looks like my cartoon there. As I said, this yellow cells will give rise to the entire body.
Sorry, and the thing to notice there is that there are three different cell fates, but they're sort of topologically arranged.
Yeah. So the blastocyst has this trophectoderm and the inner cell mass. The trophectoderm and parts of the inner cell mass will give rise to these extra embryonic tissue. And these tissue will become supporting tissue for the embryo. Part of it will give rise to the placenta, which is up here, which I have not shown in the cartoon. And so you get these different cell types, and differentiation happens early. And I can tell you more about it if anybody's interested. I can get into how that happens. This is the only image I could steal from Google, so ignore the colors, wrong colors compared to that. This sheet here, that's the epiblast. This is just a three-dimensional view. Remember that initially, this sheet is topologically equivalent to a sphere. We are a donut. We need the opening. So to make a sphere into a donut, you have to tear it. And that tear is gastrulation, starts here. And the cells differentiate and go in. Right? The initial cells that go in are mesendodermal cells that give rise to muscle, muscle particularly, and bone. Then you get endodermal cells that go in, which will give rise to the gut. The endodermal cells will come in and replace, the epiblast is here again. These are the cells coming in, tearing from the sheet, coming in. And these will form the internal organs in the body. And there is some detail here I can tell you, if anybody's interested. Again, beautiful work by Hajin Tanakis' lab at Rockefeller. Sloan Kettering. Embryonic stem cells, if you take a colony, add BMP, which is a signal that triggers all of this, recapitulate some of the events during gastrulation, you get these progression of cell fates. Cells peel off and start walking. Sorry, the images on the screen are not as nice. And these cells are going to become mesoderm and endoderm. These cells are going to become neurons. Okay. So the early embryo is a sheet. Stem cell colonies are a sheet. You add signal, stem cell colonies behave kind of like the embryo, or at least a poor man version of the embryo. How does all of this happen? So you get serious morphogenesis, but this morphogenesis has to be coupled with cell fate. How morphogenesis and cell fate are coupled to each other, and if one drives the other, or if there is feedback, is an open question. And Elliot brought up some things in plants. As far as the talk is concerned, there are these four key signaling pathways. There are a few more, but what's really surprising, and I'll come back to this later, is that there are so few signaling pathways that keep driving more and more morphogenesis. And I'll give you a beautiful example early in human development. I think it's beautiful. But, so as I said, signals drive morphogenesis. So in response to signals, as you saw in the previous talks with flies, you get some signal secreted. The initial signal that drives everything is called BMP. And the protein here is BMP4. These extra embryonic ectoderm secretes BMP. BMP comes along, and the cells of the epiblast see BMP. And the thought is that perhaps there is a diffusion gradient. Again, you see this E5.5. That's 5.5 days after it's embryonic day 5.5. And you'll see that number change. Another thing to note, I've aligned all my embryos so that this is the posterior side. That's the anterior side. And I'll just stick to that. And it's important for you to remember. BMP4 triggers the expression of another signal called Wnt. Wnt is an extremely sticky signal. It's lipid modified, and doesn't diffuse much, but it hangs around here and gets going on the posterior side. These are the cells that are going to eventually tear off from the sheet and go in. On the other side of the embryo, that's the anterior side, these cells secrete inhibitors. So essentially, these signals presumably are not active in this part of the embryo because there are anti-signals, if you like, being secreted from this side. Signals coming in from this side, you get progressive patterning. And the day is changing slowly. Wnt then drives nodal signal. That propagates a bit more. Yeah?
So the asymmetry is already built into the embryo from early stages?
Yes. And I'll show you more asymmetry even in terms of the geometry built in very early in a second. So Wnt drives nodal, you get a propagation of this pattern. That's about E6.5. And at this stage, the cells up here start pinching off. This is the apical side, that's the basal side. They start pulling away and moving into the gap here. And those are going to become mesoderm and endoderm. I made a note here of some references in bold because I just wanted to say random things from historical, I mean, not historical by my age, but historical nonetheless by many of you. Papers that are open questions, beautiful experiments. So Janet Rochon in 1982, and there are papers before in the early 70s, did these experiments where they took E5.5 embryos, E4 embryos, took two of them, put them together. The embryo became twice the size, re-implanted into the mouse, and looked at development. And then measured the size as a function of time. These are heroic experiments. We've done some mouse experiments that I'll show you. The embryo looks like a piece of crud. I can't tell what's embryo, it's about less than a millimeter big. And so she put them together, put them in, took them out, and measured the size at different stages. And what they found is that by the time this event happened, all the embryos were at the normal size. So essentially, if you increase the size of the embryo somehow by fusing two embryos together, gastrulation happens faster. So we don't know why that is. So there's certainly coupling between size and time, and these are also open questions. So as I said, signals, anti-signals, if you like, if you're a physicist, drive cell fate patterning. Cell fate patterning is related to morphogenesis. And once you get morphogenesis, you get a donut. And once you get a donut, you get you. Or a mouse in this case. Oh, no, you too, because the other one was human. So as I said, the key assumption, and this you've been hearing in the talks through the day, is that there are gradients of signals that pattern the embryo. So the secreted must be diffusion going through. I just want to add two pieces of complication to this business about diffusion. The first is the embryo geometry that you asked about. We just took a mouse embryo, and this is somewhat recent work, and poked a needle in and injected fluorescein. When you inject fluorescein, fluorescein fills up this cavity here. That's that cavity. And you see that fluorescein leaks through only on this side, not on that side. And it goes around, and it goes into the gap here. If the images were better, you could see a narrow band of fluorescein right there. So what's happening to the fluorescein that you inject? It goes in here, goes through the gap only on this side. Doesn't seem to be a gap on that side. And we've done tight junction stains, and there's an intact tight junction there. Here there's a gap. It goes in there. Why is that important, that the geometry of the embryo has a little tear on one side? Turns out, when we looked, all TGF-beta receptors, and I'm just showing you data for BMP, are basolaterally localized. So if you look at this embryo, these are the tight junctions. These are the nuclei. All the receptors are here. So all the receptors are sitting on the edge here. There are no receptors on this side. So the signal to reach the receptor has to crawl in through this little space between the visceral endoderm and the epiblast, and it has to go in there through the gap to reach the receptor. So what actually does happen is that the cavity fills up with signal. Some of the signal finds its way through this gap and diffuses in and causes patterning. I'll show you why it's in the lumen. I just told you that all of the drama happens here on the posterior side, right? Not on the anterior side. And I told you that the receptors are all at the bottom. If I could take the receptors and flip it over, either here or there, I could show you that there is BMP in the lumen, right? So how do I flip it over? You align all the TGF-beta receptors. Turns out there is a conserved amino acid motif right next to the phosphorylation site. You mutate that motif, you can flip the receptor. So we flip the receptor. This is the anterior side again. And you see signaling. This is the protein that goes into the nucleus in response to BMP on the anterior side of the embryos, the image I'm showing you. We also have data down here. Okay? So first lesson is that geometry matters. Maybe the shapes of these different animal embryos matter. And signal is not easily accessible to the cell. The cells are all polarized. As it's been mentioned many times, they're all epithelial. So the position of the receptors must be important. And as I said, take all TGF-beta receptors, all sequence species, they all have this motif. So it must be that all TGF-beta receptors in all species are localized. Yes?
Sorry, is the leakage, not with the flip, but the leakage in the wild type, is that where the wind signaling is origin and where you have those cells crawling out? Is that...
That's going to be the place where things are going to start crawling out. This is much before.
This is what allows that to be the leakage point?
Because there is a detachment between this extraembryonic tissue and the epiblast right at the outset. So there is a...
On the posterior side.
Only on the posterior side.
I see.
Okay. So suddenly it seems like geometry of the embryo matters. And since epithelial tissues are so common during development, it's worth asking where the receptors are when you start thinking about diffusion. So that's lesson one about signals.
So as you... told us, I guess, the tight junctions are also polarized.
The cells are polarized. And the tight junctions are proteins made of cadherin and the ZO1. They are waterproof.
Right, and they're only on one side.
They're on the apical side.
Yes. And how does that happen? Is that understood?
All epithelial tissues are like this, is all I know. Okay. I don't know how the machinery was set up to do this, but that's how it is.
Sorry, but I was curious whether BMP is still in the lumen or on the surface, on the apical surface of the cells. Is it really...
Good question. You must be one of the referees. So what we have to do is suck out the liquid and put it on the cells and see if it responds. That's a good point. But the point is that, that's a flippant remark, but I think that's a very good question. I think we don't know if it's here. Only thing I can tell you is that BMP is extremely water soluble, unlike WNT. WNT, I would think, sticks to the membrane. These ligands are soluble. Okay. It's a good question, perfectly legitimate. I hid the label for the red color from you, and if you look at stem cells too, they're polarized. All the receptors are at the bottom. Okay, and Sujia and Bhruvannu's lab have shown similar things for several of the receptors and stem cells. Okay, so that's one. Lesson number two. When you add signal, the cell sees the signal within an hour. How does the cell see the signal? You get some phosphorylated protein that goes into the nucleus, you add signal, and you know that the cell has seen the signal. By the time it makes this decision, first thing, cells are epiblast. The first decision that these cells make is either to become muscle, bone, and gut, or neuron and skin. That's the first decision. As I just told you, BMP drives this decision, so add signals, you'll get these fates. When you add signal, the cell sees the signal in an hour. The time it takes for the cell to actually express master regulators that are defined by developmental biologists takes somewhere between 60 and 72 hours in human. So signal is in, takes a bloody long time by any measure to actually express the downstream fate markers and to set the time scale. Oh, I had that here. Cell cycle time in human is about 24 hours. Okay, so it's more than just signal reception and make a fate. Something funny is happening there, and I think it's perfectly legitimate to say we don't know what's happening in this interval. So it's not a cell making a decision. It's cells' daughters that make the decision. So it's like daughters and granddaughters. Assuming that the decision is made when the fate markers come on,
which is also questionable, as I'll show you in a bit. Third thing you need to know, response of the cells to the same signals changes over a course of time. And here you will see in the data I'll show you that the response of the cell over a three-day period, 72 hours is three, isn't it? Yeah. Three-day period, the response of these cells to BMP and nodal signaling will be digitally different as I go. And this ties into something else that I'll come to at the end of the talk. If you take human embryonic stem cells and let them go and don't do anything to them, they adopt neural fate. And not only do they adopt neural fate, they adopt forebrain fate and make you cortical neurons. Okay? So you just let it go, do nothing. It'll get there and keep going. As soon as you release these stem cells from the maintenance conditions, which now are very well defined, it's just two inhibitors, it's not some broth, and we know what those two inhibitors are and what they do. You add BMP nodal, again, oh, the images are not coming on nicely, sorry, I should change colors. You add BMP nodal as soon as you take out the cells from stem cell maintenance media, they'll turn yellow, SOC17 endoderm marker. These are going to be the cells that are going to crawl out and go in through that gap. And these are human, though, so they crawl out differently from a mouse, but these are endoderm.
And they crawl in your experiments by interactions with the agar?
That's not relevant, right? I'll come back to crawling maybe at the end. But the point is that they make it. You add it one day after removing signal. And again, in my screen, there are these beautiful blue dots here. Bad color again. Blue dots, skin. So one day later, add BMP nodal, same amount. And remember, in these experiments, we already knew that BMP receptors are basally localized. So we're adding all the signal from below so that everybody's seeing the signal. You get different fates. This is DAPI, just nuclear staining. You see a whole bunch of skin progenitors here, SOC17, endoderm progenitors there. Add it in 2 days, you get only skin. Again, one cell cycle time, roughly. Add it about 3 days later, you get a certain kind of neuron. Yeah?
Does this depend on the concentration of the signal?
You're just adding a hell of a lot. Okay. We don't know what the endogenous concentration is. We're not looking at gradients, we're just adding a lot. And if you add more, you don't get any more skin cells.
And do you think this delay in when you expose it to these signals replicates what you see, what's happening in biology, or is it?
Good question. That's why I put this thing in bold.
Okay.
People have done experiments. Sorry, let me answer that question and get to you. People have done experiments in a mouse. This is from 2013. So as I said, the embryo is a cup. Posterior side is going to become SOC17. That's the yellow color. This side is going to become skin. They can take cells from this side, put it on that side at different times, and see if when you transplant the cell becomes SOC17. Doesn't. After a time, it doesn't. These transplantation experiments are messy, but with these stem cells, you get very clean experiments. Okay? So three lessons about signals. One, geometry matters. Second, takes a bloody long time for the cells to respond to the signals. Third, when you add the signal is important.
I didn't quite understand the protocol here. What marks a zero if you don't add BMP until 2 days later?
Good question. Zero marks, so these cells are present, as you can maintain them as stem cells forever. Mm-hmm. They're present in a medium with two inhibitors. Mm-hmm. You remove the inhibitors and cells will start marching down.
You remove the inhibitor, but you do not...
You don't add any signal. Once you remove the inhibitor, you add signal, you get that. And you add it at different times, you get different fates. Okay. So, yeah.
So, I suspect you might actually address this question later on. But your second, one of your three principles here.
I don't know if they're principles.
It takes a long time to respond. So part of that is due to what it is that you are choosing to
very good question.
As a response. And so,
very good
so I'm
question.
Curious whether now with new technologies and other things, whether you think that it's not doing anything and then responding after quite a long time, or if there's a gradient of things that happen that you can have a tech.
We don't know the answer, okay. But you set me up nicely. So The point is, we don't know what's happening here. If we could somehow read the mind of the cell going, oh, are you going to turn left or turn right as it's going along, then maybe we can start asking basic questions. We can sort cells that have made up their mind as they go along. Maybe some of the cells have already come here, they can't change their mind anymore. Other cells are not, and then you can look at daughters and mothers. Do they make the same decision? Do siblings make the same decision? Do they make mistakes? None of that is accessible to us because we don't know what's happening during the 72 hours. And so it would be nice to see what the cell is thinking of doing as it's doing it. Yeah.
So here you're focusing on the internal state of the cell, but yeah, it's also possible that cells release secondary signals which influence, which change the external state, which change the state of the media in which they are kept.
That is a very good question. That's a very, very good question. We just know from experiments, I don't have the time to get into that, that's not the case. Okay? In this particular case, all cells are being exposed to the same environment, and we can change the internal state and make it responsive, but I don't have time to get to things like that. Yeah.
So in the second condition that you have, where you were getting some cells expressing keratin and others don't, if all the cells are
Good question. I get it. What's happening is that the cells are, I'll just tell you the answer, I don't have the time to get into it, but the cells are marching down this way, okay? What we find is there is a clean commitment point at which point the response of the signal changes and we know now molecular markers for it. What's happening with these stem cell systems is that they're not marching along in synchrony, they're sort of marching along at different rates. So some cells are on one side of the commitment point, some cells are on the other side.
But it doesn't look entirely stochastic either, because you have this population in the center and then you have another population surrounding it.
Very good question. The problem with the population surrounding it is that it started walking off from the colony. The population in the center stays connected. But if you, these are all endodermal cells, they're undergoing EMT. So they're sort of dispersing.
Okay,
so that's part of the reason for the correlation. And I can get into a, maybe this is worth an offline long discussion, which I'm very happy to do. These are all very, very good questions. So as I said, if we can read the mind of the cell, then we can sort of see what it's deciding to do. Wouldn't it be fun to do it? The other point, which is what started my work at the Allen Institute a while back, was the following. If I could sequentially read the mind of the cell all through, I should be able to get the entire lineage tree, which will get me back to my question of what is making the different cell types of the brain. So if I can read the mind of the cell as it's making decisions, I can say whether it's thinking of turning left or right. If I can read it all the way, then I can construct the lineage tree. So that's where we started. And just to give you an answer right away, we can. Cells start off yellow. In real time, we can tell you what the cells are thinking of doing just by coloring two proteins, and I'll come back to names of proteins later. Cells in the middle are going to become neurons. Cells in the edges are going to become mesendodermal progenitors. And the terminal markers have not turned on yet. Okay? So I can play the movie again, start with yellow, and then they turn red or green. So if you're a chemist, this looks like reaction coordinates. You can track the cells in real time. But as my advisor would tell me, chemists don't have numbers on their axes, so these are probably more like order parameters. You can put numbers on them. You can say where the cell is along the trajectory just by based on the ratio of two colors. Okay. And we got these answers from looking at single cell sequencing. So I want to switch gears for a bit because of the audience and tell you about the challenges with data analysis and how one might get around to finding these sort of places or key dynamics that allow you to track what the cell is thinking of doing well before the fate choice is made. And I think these problems don't have enough physicists working on them, and I think they're a fun problem. So I want to do it in real time. I want to do it in live cells, so I can only color two or three genes. 2,000 transcription factors, 2,000 choose trees is a large number. How do I find the right set of factors, which are not the master regulators of the lineage because these dynamics are set up well before, right? So I want to solve this problem. So I'll set this problem up in a rather different way, but I'll tell you what the experiment is, right? You take cells at E5.5, 6.5, this also says 6.5, different times along the time of development. Break up the embryo, and there are more and more experiments like this now, and so data sets are sort of insane. You can get anything you want. You get cells at time T1, cells at time T2, cells at time T3. The art form here, and just to jump ahead again, working with human fetal tissue, dissociation is the hard part. Once you have the cells dissociated, everything, you just hand it over to a company and they do it for you. So you do single cell sequencing. I'm advertising for some company here, which I stole from the internet, which I don't want to mention by name. Maybe I should have covered that up. But you can do single cell sequencing to get transcripts. You get around 10,000 transcripts a cell. Okay. So human genome, 30,000 genes roughly, you get 10,000 transcripts with lots of ifs and buts. You only measure the 3' end of the transcript, so you don't get any splice variants or anything else. And you can get levels of genes. So in preparation for this talk, trying to replicate what we did with human neural development, I was like, okay, let's play with this data and see what happens. Thankfully, somebody collected the data for us just in time for this meeting. So we took that data. And the point is to discover from this data what biologists know for decades. And that turns out to be hard. You can make stories about the data, but okay. So I'll tell you what the problems are. First point is that every measurement, every data point, you're measuring 10,000 variables. So every point lives in some 10,000 dimensional space. So every dot is a cell. Level of gene 1 is x-axis, level of gene 2 is y-axis, level of gene 3 is, and then level of gene 10,000 is 10,000th axis. So there is a point there. We did exactly what they did in the paper. That's the answer. And no, it's a hard problem. I'm not trying to be flippant here. It's a hard problem. That's the answer. Look at cell-cell correlations. That's the answer. And then you can stare at tea leaves and try to find pieces here, going back to known markers. But my job is to find how to read the mind of the cell, whether it turns left or right. So the question is, how do you get it from here? The state of the field is not very good. There is no difference between data visualization and data analysis. And this is data visualization. I'll tell you how this is done. I have to teach a course, and I ask the students, can you take a cube and draw it on a blackboard? You can, right? You know how to draw a cube on a blackboard. Now I say, take a cube and draw it on a line. And suddenly you're stunned, right? Because how the hell do you draw a cube on a line? But this is 10,000 dimensional space drawn on two dimensions. You can get any answer you want to. And the only way to draw a cube on a line is to tear it, deform it. And what this algorithm does is tries to keep local distances the same. So it's squishing the data, but trying to keep local distances the same as much as it can, but that's what you get.
Sorry, now your question is that, is it a principal component analysis?
No, it's beyond principal component. Yeah.
All right.
But we know from our heroes that there's supposed to be discrete states here, there's supposed to be digital transitions here, you see none of it, everything is continuous and wispy because you're just squishing a cube into a line. So another point here, which is related to the same problem, is that data density is zero. 10,000 dimensions, you need exponentially large amounts of data to fill the space. So if you measure everything about me, I'm extremely lonely because I'm the only person like me, and you don't even have to measure too many things about me. And I don't descend into loneliness gradually, I descend into loneliness exponentially. I'm like, so the point is that once you have lonely data, no matter how much data you have, because the volume of the space is growing so rapidly, conventional statistics methods break down. Only way to increase data density to be able to do statistics is to reduce dimensions. That gets us to PCA. So let's look at PCA from scratch for a second. And this is all work by a student, Sam Melton, who will be here in a few weeks, I think. There's another problem with data dimension reduction. Let me look at data. Let's just play around with data for a bit just to explain to you what the problems are, because this is a fun problem. Let me look at data like this. How many clusters do you see? Two. Informative signature is here. Noisy signature is here. Okay. So here, my signal dimension is 1, noise dimension is 1. And the other point is that I've just made sure that all the variances are unit variants. I have no information in the variance of my data because I don't want to compare variances in apples and oranges, X and Y being different genes. Here, noisy dimensions are 2, so it looks like 2 pancakes. And the informative dimension is still 1. Okay? So if you think that in your data, and decades of developmental biology has told us this, that only a few things matter maybe for classification of cell types, you will see how badly messed up you are once you do PCA. Why is that? Let's look at 2 points. What do you do? Sorry, I forgot to mention, I do not know what the relevant dimensions are. All I know is that there are some small number of relevant dimensions that matter. And sorry, we'll get back to data analysis, and I'll show you that the mouse data looks much better when you do it right. Let's say the dimension of the full space is D. That's our 10,000. Let's say that the dimensions of our meaningful space is some smaller dimension, DS. So in this case, DS is 1, D is 3. What do you do for PCA? You measure distances between things. It's always like distances, correlations are distances. So if you measure distances in D, you get some distance DD between 2 typical points. Measure distances in DS, you get some distance. The important distance for biology is this one and not that one. So now if you look at the correlation between these 2 quantities, it's very easy to show that the correlation goes like DS over D. So if you do PCA, correlation analysis, taking all of your genes into account and only a small fraction of genes matter, then you're in trouble. So PCA is not a good starting point either because you don't know what dimensions are relevant. And here is a demonstration. This direction is where DS over D is decreasing. Here are predefined synthetic data with 7 clusters. And you increase this pancake direction, add more and more dimensions that are noisy. This is the same algorithm that we use for the mouse data. You get something like that. Everything gets mixed up. And this is precisely because there is no correlation between the distance you're measuring and the actual distance that's relevant. And I don't know how many physicists are in the audience, but it's easy to see that the clustering gets messed up too. So if you look at, if you try to make a cluster and look at the entropy of the cluster, the typical volume in d-dimensional space, if you have n data point scales like n raised to 1 over d, that's your typical distance, typical distance between points. If you take that distance and try to build a volume in this informative space, the volume goes like n raised to ds over d. And I've just taken the log here, and the entropy of your clusters, even if you try to cluster, goes up. So even if you started with pure clusters, if you add enough noisy dimensions, your clusters are all wrong. Okay? So clustering is also in trouble because of the same reason that you're in a space where distances are wrong. And we have to do all of this to go back to this yellow, red, green movie. So let's look at 2 limits. And we'll solve the problem in these 2 limits and then go back to mouse data and look at these 2 limits and show that things happen. And then I'll go to, I have time, don't I?
Yes,
I have time. I'll be done well before time. And then let me go to human data and show you that we can discover new kinds of cell types that exist only in the higher primate brain after doing all this mumbo jumbo. So let's consider a problem. First limit that we want to solve the problem in is DS over D. Is much less than 1. Okay, so let's just set DS equal to 1. Information exists only in 1 dimension, exactly like our cartoon before. So there is a second difficult limit, and let's solve the problem in both limits. Second limit is that let's consider the fact that, let's say you had m clusters. So in this high dimensional space, somehow you have m clusters, and you know that somehow in d dimensions. Okay. Let's look at cluster I and j. Sorry, too much text. Let's look at cluster I and j, 2 of these m clusters. Let's say that there is some space of dimension ds that's separating these 2 clusters exactly like the cartoon, right? So for every pair of clusters, there will be a low dimensional space that's separating these clusters. So for every pair, I can define a subspace that's informative and everything else that's crap. Okay? The second limit, which is difficult, is when the intersection between any two subspaces like this is null. So I'll show you what the data looks like when this happens, which throws for a loop anything to do with calculating moments and trying to find out what's happening. So here is a picture of the data. I'm going to show you a movie. Here are the clusters arranged in this limit. Remember, besides this, you have all the pancake directions, which are hard to show. But if this movie plays, those are the clusters. So what's happening here is that this cluster and that cluster are separated by one particular dimension. For all the other clusters, that one dimension is noise. So if you just look at the full data distribution, it looks like this. But if you color your data distributions by the clusters, those are the two clusters. All the other clusters are here. So essentially, if you can solve the problem in this limit, ds is 1, d is large. And if clusters are only pairwise separable, that's what this means. It means that I do not have a unique marker compared to all of you in this room. Compared to you, I have brown eyes. Compared to you, I don't have a beard. Compared to you, I have glasses, I guess. I have to think, yeah. So you see, so based every pair, I have a unique feature. And so these clusters are all pairwise separable, but they're not uniquely identified. If you can solve that problem, then you can solve all problems within a class. So we can solve this problem now. And what we want to do, and I'll just sketch the solution very briefly and then go back to mouse. We want to calculate weights for different dimensions. We want to say this dimension is good, this dimension is bad, and so on. And so we want to calculate some measure of goodness. We want to simultaneously calculate clusters because we don't know what the clusters are, what the cell identities are in this case. And we want to compute some joint probability distribution of these things, which is hard to do. But it turns out that if you can sort of compute this and integrate over all possible clusters, you don't care about clusters, just integrate over it, you just get P of G, and you can find the good dimensions. So in terms of practice, what we do is the following, and it turns out to be the same thing as I told you in terms of the wee bit of math. Take your clusters. Don't worry about what the clusters are. Just make little clusters locally, right? And take one pair of those little clusters. You've made many, many, many clusters. Find a plane that divides them. Find the normal to the plane. And we have constrained this plane to have an L1 norm constraint so that the plane is always pointed along some of the axes because we are looking for a small number of genes. And find the projection of these normals along your gene directions and calculate the weight. And do this over a whole ensemble of clusters. Don't worry about clustering, just cluster like crazy. Do it over a whole ensemble that equates to integrating all overall clustering configurations with different cluster numbers. Okay, is a cluster number. P of C given K is the probability of a cluster configuration given the cluster number. This is the weight for a particular pair of clusters for a particular cluster configuration. Add it over all cluster configurations, calculate the weight. And then once you do this, you can solve the hard problem in these two limits. And we can also show scaling relations where GS over GN, these are the good direction weights divided by the bad direction weights. Goes like d over square root of ds. Remember, all other methods had trouble when d got large. This one does better when d gets large. And if you're interested, I can tell you exactly why it's d over square root of ds. It's easy to understand. And then you have another part of the scaling function, which is this part, which is just related to the entropy of your mini clusters. Okay.
Explain again how mini clusters are defined.
So you take your favorite clustering algorithm.
Yeah.
Build small mini clusters using any clustering algorithm you want, but very, very locally. So you're assuming that locally in the full space, you're still okay. Otherwise, you're lost. Locally, you're okay.
You need a metric? How do you define locally again?
Locally is defined by the distances in this Euclidean space, each axis being one of the gene expression levels.
N is the number of data points?
N is the number of data points.
Heck, you gave this to a machine learning algorithm later.
Let me clarify that. That's a very good question. Machine learning is supervised learning. I need pictures of dogs and cats. I need to label them, teach the machine to say, tell it first, this is a dog, this is a cat, this is a dog, this is a cat, 100,000 times. And then you show it a picture of a dog or a cat, and it'll tell you whether it's a dog or a cat. So that's supervised learning. This is unsupervised learning. You do not have any labeled data. You do not have any cluster identities labeled to train any kind of machine learning network. Well, that's a good question because people sort of throw machine learning at everything. no, they don't throw machine. I mean, people who do machine learning know what machine learning is, but it's sort of hard. No, yeah, it's not. It's yeah, there are different problems. So here we did this with the mouse data, and these are different clusters. These are the genes, which I've miniaturized for your convenience. And I'll go through this data. And the point is that you can start from the data instead of looking at mouse embryology literature and go back and learn mouse embryology from just data analysis, which was the point of this talk. I was trying to see if I could take the data and then explain mouse embryology backwards to you, which one should be able to do if the data analysis is worth anything. Here is one cluster. We can go back to in situ staining. These are those cells secreting inhibitors. There is an inhibitor that called Cerebrus that these cells secrete. These cells express it. So your dissociated embryo cells must have come from there. You get cells here. These are, after they go through, they give rise to lateral plate and paraxial mesoderms. There are different kinds of mesoderms. Those are here. You get neuromesodermal cells. And the reason I'm telling you about lateral plate and neuromesodermal cells is that these two together give you a whole locomotory apparatus. So this is the entire motor system of the body, those two cell types. You see cardiac mesoderm progenitors. You see epiblast cells. Ooh, I lost one. My favorite one. Oh, it's not here, sadly. It's one of these clusters. I must have deleted the slide by mistake. You also see erythroid cells. The embryo has a separate hematopoietic lineage, and you see progenitors of those cells coming out of the streak here. So you see all kinds of cell types. And you go back to the literature, go to in situ staining, you discover, if you look at these genes magnified, and if you were comfortable with mouse developmental biology, you will see all the names make a hell of a lot of sense. There are no surprises here. You've just rediscovered what people knew all along. But the point is that if you, just to be preachy, if you show this slide and say things are much more complicated than you thought, it's worth thinking about what they're doing. Okay. So after this, so the, yeah.
Just toggle one back, so I'm sort of still curious. So right now you chose to label, what, 5 clusters, 6 clusters?
No. There are about 30 clusters. I'm just showing you some.
Yeah, but it's not just one row that you,
yeah.
You gave an
answer. Yeah, so I'll tell you what. Mm-hmm. The problem with clustering is that it's like looking at ink blotches. So what you do is overcluster,
yeah. And
then try to merge clusters based on annotation. So there is no, so that's what we're doing.
Where's the question is, so effectively, right? Those things are presumably still clustered together, so they belong to one clade.
Yes.
Right. So presumably that little bunch is just not a leaf, but a branch point high on the tree.
Exactly.
Another question is, so this was null, right? But suppose you want to discover something. Right, and that clade is split into two. So how do you know whether this is real split or
made up stuff?
Clustering split.
Right. At this point, you don't. What you would have to do is time series analysis at different times and try to relate back over time. This is just one time point that I did. This was just E6.5 for the purposes of this talk. But presumably, if you do it over time, you can get lineages. We have done this with neural differentiation.
And there's probably another trick that is hidden under the hood there, which is how to choose that mini clustering. So you started
right.
with 10,000, there was some square root, so do you choose these mini clusters to contain?
We chose mini clusters, we've looked over a range. Order 100, order 50, and you can try it with different mini cluster sizes and see if you get the same robust answer. For that, there is no cure. The problem is that you're trying to start with, you have to say which cells are together. You have no clue what your DS is, the good dimensions. So the only way you can build something is to start with the data you have. But instead of just trying to cluster everything into big groups, you make little clusters hoping that even in this big space, little clusters are just still locally informative.
And that parameter actually controls over-clustering.
So
if you start with very small ones,
exactly.
You'll end up with lots of loose leaves.
Exactly.
Okay, exactly.
Sharon, I have a question. So once you enforce the L1 norm on that plane and you find the normal, you now sort of basically you average over
lots of clusters, tens of thousands
sort
of clustering configurations.
Clustering out. But I guess my question now is, so you get these different normal vectors that are pointing in a few dimensions. One sort of technical question about what is the stiffness parameter in that?
No, and so what we actually do is maximize the L1 constraint so that the normal is pointing along only one.
Oh,
but we do it so many times that we get the entire distribution.
And we get them for every possible pair. Then what do you do with that very long list?
Oh, you just get a probability distribution for every gene.
Okay, so you put your stiffness in.
Yeah, you don't want it to be a tuning parameter, right? I mean, that's so we just say, okay, keep cutting.
Yeah, got it.
So it takes a while to run, but you get all the genes that matter. And the reason that this is important to check with the literature is because of what I'm going to tell you next, which is to do with human brain development. So this was an exercise. These genes that I told you about to read the mind of the cell, whether it's going left or right, is hidden in there. And you have to do some more stuff to find those genes. It's published, so I won't talk about it because I don't want to bore you with statistical inference. So the final bit was to see if we can use this stuff to actually discover some new biology. And the question we asked, this is all with a team at the Allen, to see if there are cell types that are specific to human brains, and if there are sort of new cell types, can we find them? So we got lots of human fetal tissue at different times. Most tissue shows up like that, so you don't have much idea about the spatial geometry. There are some that look like this, which are valuable. So what we did was cut this in half, take one half, and dissociate, and do single-cell sequencing again, to then run it through our algorithms to see if we can find cell types. Keep the other half, because once you've found good markers like we did in the last matrix, you can go back and immunostain, if you can, to see where these cells are at, these cells that you discovered, if they have anything special.
When you said like one hemisphere...
It's the same hemisphere. It's hard to tell where precisely it came from, but it's early enough that things are somewhat homogeneous. So we did the same thing and did the same mumbo-jumbo, and we found cell types. And we found one cell type, and I'm going to tell you the name of one gene in this talk, besides the signaling ones, HOPX, which is expressed in the human brain in a particular class of cells determined by single-cell sequencing. This gene is not expressed in a mouse. It's implicated in colon cancer. So this gene implicated in colon cancer exists in the human brain. Then the question is, where are these cell types? Before I tell you where they are, we went back to the fetal tissue and antibody stained for HOPX. These are the cell types. I just want you to look at the morphology. It's got a stalk, and you have this bulb here. And I'll show you that with stem cells, we can make the same kind of cell types in a dish. So now I have to tell you about where these cell types are, and that's where things get interesting. Let me look at a mouse brain. This is forebrain cortex. I just want you to look at this region between these two dotted lines. This is the ventricle. Progenitor cells live here. Progenitor cells divide and make the neurons, the different layers of your cortex. This is called the subventricular zone. This region is called the outer subventricular zone. This is the outer subventricular zone in mouse. Right? Look at the same region between dotted lines in human. There. So there is enormous expansion of this region during fetal development. And you get mitotic proliferation. And then the whole region collapses because all the divided cells move out and become we don't know what they become yet because we can't do lineage tracing in humans, but this region exists morphologically in chimps and humans. So these cells that we found are there. So there is a proliferative zone expressing genes associated with proliferation, at least in the context of cancer, and you can find those cell types. This is from our fetal tissue, just that region I showed you that expands. This is to scale. You can just see this region expanding enormously through proliferation from 10 post-conceptual weeks to 18. It just blows up. And it's thought that this expansion is what gives us the wrinkled cortex and all the cell types, but we don't know yet. But we can find the cell type. And just to demonstrate the power of stem cell systems, we also set up a stem cell system where, over time, in a dish, you can recapitulate some aspects of cortical development, at least the different cell types. You get the different layer neurons over time. And this is an experiment over about 100 days. And these cell types that we found show up in the dish. Same morphology, same gene expression, antibody stained by HOPX. And now we have a GFP cell line with the HOPX marked with GFP. So now we can start asking, where did these cells come from? What do they make? And things with human take a long time, but that's where we are at. So I think this combination of computation, looking at humans, and stem cell systems, one has opportunities of some sort. And I think the best opportunities are actually computational. And we've done some stuff with lineage tracing and whatnot, which I won't bore you about.
Charlotte, did you already say what happens to the brain if this gene is not expressed in those cells?
We don't know that.
Oh.
This is human-specific. We don't know how to do that.
I see. And the gene...
is expressed in mouse.
And has a predicted molecular function.
It has a predicted molecular function. It's implicated in colon cancer. So it's misregulated in mouse in colon cancer.
But the only brain expression that you know of so far is in these human brain cells. But the functional significance we don't know.
We don't know. So the point would be to make these HOPX GFP lines, let them go, and delete HOPX and see what cell types are missing. I mean, this you can only do in vitro, but it's a long road.
Maybe more almost philosophical question about how to deal with these data. So you were able to create a really interesting story about this because there's this background knowledge of HOPX that is expressed in certain places and not in this region of the brain. So there's a lot of biology.
Already known because HOPX is known in other roles, right.
And I feel like when I listen to a lot of single cell sequencing talks, there's a lot of things that we know a lot about, we can learn
some more about. Yeah.
But I think the technology in some ways is sold as, here's this way we get to explore amazing creatures from the bottom of the sea and other things. And just from your perspective, the way that you do data analysis, is that a reasonable approach to say that if we really know nothing, that we can anchor ourselves and we're really relying on basically the ability to pull things apart in the various mathematical ways?
No. It's perfectly right. I was sort of processing.
Yeah.
So here's the point. If the space is completely empty and the data density is zero, you have to figure out what to throw out. If you're looking for separated pancakes or multimodal distributions, you have a criterion for throwing things out. But without throwing things out, that's what you get. But if you know biology and you can throw things out or choose things, you should. There is nothing holier than you just because somebody did it ab initio and produced this and then comment. I mean, what irritates me is, I mean, this would be not for this audience, but yeah, I'll shut up. But yeah.
So for the foreseeable future, it really.
But I think that's a challenge of our times, right?
In question for which we do have a fair bit of biology.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, but the point is, how do you extract info? I think that's a challenge of our times. And I think people coming with cranks and do stuff, but I think that's where the students here could have a serious role. This is a very hard question. The problems are very hard. Making inferences are very hard. And this sort of high-dimensional data business is not just with single cells. It's personalized medicine. It's the same problem. If it's neural recording data, it's the same problem. And so the question is, how do you choose the right variables? How do you make any inference worth its while to test experimentally instead of just showing pictures is, I think, a hard problem. And I think it's worth going after. So even these experiments from 50 years back where they fused mouse embryos, and I mean, it would be fun to look at now, just redo those experiments and then analyze. But then the question is, can you fool the cell into doing gastrulation early, the embryo? That would be the key experiment, right? Instead of just saying, oh, these genes go up, these genes go down. I don't know how to get there. But that, I think that's the problem of our times, I think. I think that would be fun to think about. And I think there's lots of geometry. It's sort of data geometry. It's like how the data is arranged in the space and trying to understand it, I think, is fun.
Sure, two questions. One, I guess I've been trying to do these sorts of things. And let's say you had some ground truth data where you did single cell sequencing of your mouse embryo and you really had different clusters. But of course, they're different numbers of cells of different fates.
Yeah.
And then, I guess I'm saying, how does this approach, when you're trying to draw a plane which has a normal...
I mean, this is all different numbers of cells in different...
It is, right?
Yeah,
so,
of course.
But you just had the number N,
that's
which was
sort
total
of a
number. I guess
envelope.
I'm asking you, so how, it sort of really starts falling apart when you have one big cluster, one really small one, and...
I mean, it starts falling apart in some regimes and not in others, so you have to think about it carefully. Yeah. You have to think about it. What I didn't tell you about is all of this is data analysis and it doesn't mean anything. Yeah. Finally, what you have to do is do the experiment to show that these cell types mean something. And I didn't want to have a long talk, but the other thing that we've done is that we have barcoded viral libraries where we can infect these embryos. And then when you do single cell sequencing, you can tell both the lineage and the gene expression. So if you really think that these cell types matter, you should show that all of them give rise to the same set of cells down the road, right? So one can start doing these experiments, again, with single cell sequencing. Yes?
Yeah, there have been several recent papers that have described atlases of cell states in different organisms from single cell data. I was wondering how the techniques used there compared to standard dimensional reduction or what you...
They're all standard dimensionality reduction algorithms. They start off with PCA, take the high variance genes, and then do a nonlinear embedding onto two dimension.
But that looks like it's working better than what you showed for the mouse.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll tell you what the reason. If you look at adult tissue, I think the data is much easier because all these cell types are so far separated. Anything you do, you will get these cell types apart. So adult tissue is much easier to analyze. What's happening during development is that the same genes are being reused over and over again in different combinations. And so then all this data geometry starts mattering and you really have to think about what dimensions matter and what not. So we have trouble with developmental data and not with adult.
So,
if I understood your question right, I think.
So
one thing that's sort of telling in the atlas pictures is when they start to look at different stages of embryos, and you can map all those cells on the same two, you know, artificial axes. And I'm just curious, so you can get a sense for like dynamics and how the cell state transitions are occurring. And I'm just thinking in this.
But wait. But again, to just put the bar at some level, what I want at the end of the day is a prediction from those experiments as to which two genes to color. And then I want to be able to follow the cells and tell you when commitment happens
so
or not. I do not know how to, so I can describe pictures, but I don't know how to extract any relevant information, which is back to your question.
I'm just curious if you've, so in this method, dimensions will disappear, right? If they stop being useful as classifiers. And I'm just wondering if you've thought about how to integrate this method to look at, to look at the transitions between states.
Not yet, no.
Okay.
I've just been very self. I just want to look at this business about changing context.
Yeah.
With commitment, and so we just did this to see what genes to color. We can color those genes, and I can tell you precisely by looking at the cell which cell is committed and which cell is not. So I'm just after that question. This is all in service. So I haven't tried any of the. I just couldn't get the answer, so we had to do something to get the answer.
So is there any information from lineage tracing, you know, like barcoding, for example, where you follow CRISPR signatures and so on, and then see whether these cells show up, whether they relate to, and so on?
We've done that with cortical development,
okay,
with lineage tracing, and we can get whatever we predict back out. And this is all published again, so I don't want to talk about it. But, I think...
Well, I mean, you could do it in your in vitro system. But
we have done it in the in vitro system and validated it by replating clonal populations and compared the clonal. I mean, there's like a lot of work, but we've done all of it. Yeah, we've validated everything.
Just coming back to the number of states at the end, you know, somehow you, in one sense, you say, okay, two or three is not enough. Okay. On the other sense, you have like 10,000 genes that could be used. At the end, you have 30 clusters. Is there any way we can have an idea about what's the meaningful number there? Is it 30? Is it 3? When you look at this master regulator, you have 4 genes. You know, so I think you have 4, that's enough.
But it depends on the lineage decision you're looking at. So what we find, and again, I mean, I should have maybe had
let's say like the stage that you are looking at. How coarse-grained you need to be.
So I think we've done stuff all the way to early cortical differentiation. And at every lineage decision, about 2 or 3 genes colored, we can tell you with very high precision where the cell is thinking of going.
So 2 or 3 is enough.
But for every lineage decision, it's not the same 2 or 3. You have to keep changing your lens as you go down.
How many lineage decisions you have on total?
I'm sorry?
So it depends how many lineages they
have. Yeah. You would have to look at every lineage decision independently.
So if you have 10 lineages, two of which is for each lineage, like 30, is a good number. Right?
Yeah.
So it means that you can reduce the whole system to 30.
You can reduce whole system to 30 to look at the dynamics of those 30 genes and say, where is the cell going? That we can show for particle differentiation. But it doesn't mean that we understand anything. It just means that we have colors which will correlate with where the cell is thinking of going. And then we have to look at those colors and start doing experiments to actually see where commitment happens. If we can sort by these colors, what is this underlying circuit? Can we make the cell go one way or the other? So we can start doing these experiments now because we can monitor what the cell is thinking of doing in real time.
I have a question about time resolution. So you talked about how there's this gap of 60 to 70 or so hours. How do you decide what is the right time frame at which to take new measurements, for example, to try and figure out what the cell...
Oh, for the single cell sequencing?
Yeah.
We've just done every... I mean, that's determined by how many times you come into the lab more than anything else. So it's once a day.
So far, not enough.
Yeah, it's once a day. Anything more than that gets rather hairy. And the cell cycle time is about 24 hours, at least at the outset, and then it slows down. So once a day should be, I mean, it seems sufficient. And the way to check if you have everything is to sample at intermediate times and see if you get new progenitor cell types or if they mix in. So for certain cases, we've actually sampled at intermediate times and shown that you get... that you've sampled enough. So.
A very stupid question about the geometry that you had at the beginning.
Yeah.
You said that there's a leakage point somewhere.
Yeah.
And it lasts for 72 hours. So why don't the BMP goes all the way through the whole embryo to this leakage point? What's limiting the spread?
So what is limiting the spread is that there is endocytosis once BMP binds to the receptors on the surface on the other side. So the receptors themselves act like a sink.
Okay, so you the BMP pool that you have is huge. So you're not limited by that amount?
No, because you still have to find the gap and diffuse through.
Okay.
And the gap is very small. So essentially, you just go through, and once you're under, you're constantly being sucked up.
So it's a point, but it's a point in the cross-section.
Yes.
Right. So it's really a line right on the boundary between two cell types.
On one side.
On one side.
Yeah.
So is it a line?
It's a little gap, it seems like, because when you inject, the fluorescein comes out only of one side.
But remember, like, the symmetry breaking is sort of coming from the other side, right, that this Wnt inhibitor. Oh. So how does the effect
I don't know where I
went. From, I guess, the anterior, let's call it the pole, presumably,
yeah.
That's a point, actually define point on the other side as opposed to a disk or...
So here. So there doesn't seem to be a gap here. There is a gap here.
On the left, it's the anterior side, right?
Yes.
So on the anterior side, it's a point, right?
The anterior side,
it's
these two have...
Source.
No, the anterior side, these two places have a tight junction between them.
Yeah, but I'm trying to understand.
Here.
This is the cross-section, right?
Yeah.
So now let's draw a circle around it.
Yeah.
So... that AVA is still a point.
AVE is still a localized region.
Yeah, it's a localized region.
Yeah.
So how do we get a localized region on the opposing pole, which doesn't look like a pole, right?
Here.
See what I'm trying to say?
No.
Well, so if I just look at things that are, I don't know, equidistant from the other pole.
Oh, from this pole? No.
Well, whatever, from AVA.
Oh, from here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
If you're looking at points that are equidistant on the cylinder.
Okay. So let's just pretend that this is
a
globe tilted, right, with a north pole sticking to the left, right?
Here.
Exactly.
So the handle is the posterior part. The other side is the anterior.
So
this is the EXE.
So how do you define a south pole as opposed to...
A disk.
Meridian going halfway to England.
I don't know. I mean, that's how it is, but I don't know. You're asking, same thing happens here, too. It's also a localized source here. It's a localized hole here? You're just saying, why is it not a disk between the two cups as opposed to some localized...
Well, so I'm trying to understand. So you already said that it's a localized hole.
Yeah.
So, and I'm trying to understand, is it an independent symmetry breaking event?
Don't know.
Or is it caused by the presence of
we don't know.
ADE?
We don't know. I mean, nobody had injected fluorescein into a mouse embryo before. We don't know. This is the first report that I know of injecting into an embryo. It sounds kind of stupid, right? Somebody must have done it 100 years back.
Oh,
and
no,
I probably
no, it's a wonderful and fascinating discovery, right? But I'm just wondering if it also means that there are two symmetry breaking events.
Or if it's the same coupled one. No, very good question. I don't know. Actually, come to think of it, I don't even know how this is set up.
Sorry, isn't fertilization the one that sets up the cell pole?
Not that I know of. No, no, not at all.
Xenopus, I'm translating from Xenopus.
No. So there must be an answer. I'm just ignorant and I'm sort of, I should know this. I should fail my qualifying exam for not knowing this. But I don't remember, or I don't know. But that's a good question. I don't know how two symmetries are broken. But again, it would be fun to start thinking, well, what's different about mammalian development compared to flies in terms of timescales and signals and so on. And I don't know, it's the same thing in flies. If cells make multiple cell divisions before they make a decision, or is it all done by the same cell at the same time? And patterning is so much faster that things are very...
Examples of plants where cells have to go through two divisions before they'll express the gene, even if the inducer is present.
Oh, wow. Should have worked on plants. Okay. No one knows. He knows the mechanism. Okay.
That's published.
Okay.
If
no,
I
didn't know that.
I would know. It has something to do with pulling methyls off the DNA.
I think it's
the
depletion of the DNA.
Yeah, I see.
Depletion of DNA. Mark.
And you have to go through a cell division to.
Two cell divisions.
Oh, I see. No, so we here have methylation data across the commitment point, and the methylation pattern stays the same somehow. So it seems more like...
Not the general methylation pattern, but the
specific... Specific location. What we see is something to do with E3 ligases and the dynamics of E3 ligases that seem to be regulating the levels of particular transcription factors. But that's sort of a way out there. I don't want to talk about it.
Sorry, Charlotte, why are the BMP antagonists in the system? So Cordin and...
Here.
Oh, those are the BMP. I thought that was Wnt. Okay,
the BMP Wnt. They're TGF-beta inhibitors. There are some of them are common inhibitors, both to BMP and nodal.
Can't read.
I guess I finished very early. Sorry.